Hi, Bill.
Hi there. How you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Missed you last week, but you seem to have a good time with Armando.
Yes. Armando and I are, I don't know about good friends, but we've had a professional relationship since my time at the Blogometer. And I think it helped that I ate crow about the Netroots investment in the Lieberman race. I was right that he lost, but I do admit that it was ultimately helpful for the cause for them to keep that story running and kind of push him off the party. So Armando was right about that one, and I was wrong.
So it seems like this week the conservative blogosphere had a bit of a spasm after the debate this week.
They're definitely frustrated with the direction the campaign has gone. I wouldn't say I'm frustrated, and I would say I'm more bored. I feel as though I'm trapped in March again, and Barack Obama has clearly sewn up the nomination, and Hillary Clinton refuses to give up, and yet we are sentenced to many more months of fake contests that the media has to play like it's the biggest thing in the world. The only upside of this is that the election is less than 4 weeks away, so the charade is going to end quicker than the Democratic primary did. So I've got that going for me.
So let it be said, Con Carroll has called the race.
Yes, although
the race is over.
Although I've had bets that Obama will win for a while now,
that
so I'm
true.
I'm just now officially bored with it.
is it fair to say that there is an increasing number of conservative bloggers who are making similar proclamations?
No one is saying. David Brooks said he thought the election was over too. No one is saying that, or not many people are saying that the election is over, but there is a lot more talk about what McCain did wrong. And I thought
pre-mortems are coming in.
Right. Not even what he did wrong, but why it was kind of not his year to begin with, or not why he was not the man in the first place. And one I particularly liked was Patrick Ruffini over at the Next Right, who blamed it on McCain's maverickness is the problem, was the thesis of this post. And so this is what he writes. He's talking after he watches the debate. I noticed this whenever someone would ask about the economy. McCain would launch into a tirade against the greedy special interests on Wall Street. Obama would tend to lead with how it affected the voter. Two very different reactions, and I can't help but think that Obama's response connected better. Yes, voters may say they are mad about corporate pay and Wall Street and do-nothing self-aggrandizing Congress, but they are ultimately looking out for number one. The most relevant questions are, and always have been, what are you going to do about my taxes, my health care, my job? This is why populism ultimately has such weak appeal. Sticking it to corporate CEOs and greedy politicians doesn't, in of itself, put food on the table. In a time of crisis, people especially want to know what this means to them. And in this light, I can't help but think that John McCain's rush to indict distant boogeymen in his Senate ease reminisces about the fighting, good fight against the bums in Washington fell a little flat. John McCain has a very distinct worldview. Contrary to some of the conventional wisdom, it is actually shining through quite nicely in this campaign. The problem is that it's ultimately not a very sellable brand of politics. Reform is an ethereal, process-oriented concept. It's what the political community does to itself. Change, on the other hand, is a reflection of what people want to do in the political community. One concept is distant to most voters, the other is direct and active. I get the sense that people don't quite know what to make of John McCain. His instincts may be sound, but his return to a few of his hobby horses, earmarks, defense contracts, populism, suggests an inward focus on his own unique brand of politics rather than a broader focus on what this means to the country. I feel much the same way. You get John McCain talking about earmarks and Fannie Mae in particular in ways that just don't mesh with the overall conservative critique of why Fannie Mae matters. So when John McCain talks about Fannie Mae, it's all because of how greedy the people who are running Fannie Mae were and how they made bad decisions, the people that were running it. There's all this corruption. Whereas the conservative critique is, the government should not, own or securitize half of the nation's mortgage. That's not a free market principle, and Fannie and Freddie shouldn't exist in the first place. John McCain's just never made that argument. He's made the, you know, Fannie Mae corruption bad guy argument, which you know, doesn't fit with the larger conservative critique of limited government.
Have conservative bloggers? I mean, I've definitely seen. I mean, you know, Barack Obama has foils too, but when he talks about Bush, McCain, and the deregulators, it's a foil that brings him back to his point that if we had more modern regulation, we wouldn't be in this crisis today. So it's an attack that comes back to a solution of his. Whereas for McCain, I would agree with what Ruffini is saying. You know, if you're talking about Washington and earmark spending, it doesn't automatically come back to a solution of how you would deal with this particular crisis. Maybe it comes back to how you deal with this very tiny amount of wasteful spending that goes on.
Right, right. With McCain, it's always, you know, what George Will has called honor politics. That's his solution to everything, is that the problem with Fannie Freddie was, you know, there wasn't enough honor, people got corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. So all we need is good honor leaders like John McCain to constantly be checking up on these people and making sure everything's going right.
I guess but my question is to you.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely been this narrative that conservatives have tried to get some larger airing to. They managed to get into Saturday Night Live, but not much else, it seems to me. That this was a government fault. That it wasn't the fault of deregulation, it was the fault of too much government intervention. Where does the conservative blogger critique take that to then say, here is our solution to dealing with this current crisis? Has that been laid out anywhere in the conservative blogosphere?
Well, no, because I don't think, you know, when Barack Obama talks about re-regulating the Wall Street environment, that doesn't solve the current credit crunch. You know, I don't think anyone says that. There's a difference between
how he would make sure this doesn't happen again.
So your question is there a conservative idea and plan for what should be done about financial markets going forward?
Well,
is that your question?
Whether it is, you know, short term, how you deal with the current credit crunch, or long term, how do we get the overarching economy back on track? I feel like I haven't seen, and I have my own blog post about this on ourfuture.org.
Uh-huh.
I'm just not seeing a lot of ideas here. I'm seeing a lot of criticisms and attempts to try to reframe the conventional wisdom about this being the fault of Bush, McCain, and deregulation. I haven't seen a lot of ideas happening. This is after about 10 years of conservatives constantly saying, we're the idea people, and Democrats and liberals have no ideas.
Let's put the short term aside. We'll get back to that with both McCain and Bush plan later. But yeah, no, long term, there definitely is a plan, or not a plan, but many ideas you're seeing on the conservative side. But, you know, they're just not that new, which, you know, is a good thing. We're conservatives. We've been saying we should, you know, Fannie and Freddie shouldn't exist. There's no reason that the federal government should be subsidizing the securitization of home mortgages to the point that a massive government duopoly owns or securitizes more than 50% of the residential real estate market in the United States. You know, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd want to revive Fannie and Freddie and, you know, recapitalize them, pat them on the head, and say, go about your merry little way. And conservatives have the polar opposite view, say, no, we need to kill these things while we can.
So there is an ideas criticism of the McCain campaign from the right, that if McCain had embraced that argument wholeheartedly, that we should abolish Fannie and Freddie, we should abolish any government involvement in the housing market, that would be a way to get the economy back on track.
No, but it would be an answer to the longer term issue of what went wrong, what should we do with financial markets going forward. But you know, it's not a you know, conservative. I mean, it's not a liberal idea either that the financial markets need a new regulatory framework. I mean, all of the regulations that we have now are all New Deal relics. It was you know, the FDR and liberals who put these into place and chopped all this up into the, you know, SEC and CFTC and FDIC, and basically, you know, tried to segregate and you know, regulate the financial market so much that you had, you know, 16 different regulators for one market, which you know, just basically made no sense. So there has been a long, argument on the right that there needs to be a vast cutting down of the amount of regulatory agencies we have looking over the financial markets into a consolidation of them, so that you only have one regulator responsible for setting rules, so that financial institutions don't have to worry about SEC regulations and commodity futures trust regulations and all the other alphabet soup of regulatory agencies they have to agree with today. Ronald Reagan talked forever about cutting down the number of regulatory agencies in Washington, D.C.
Well, and Barack Obama has as well. But it's a difference, of course, between calling for a modernizing of a regulatory framework to reflect the current state of the global market and having a cutting of regulation so there is less of it and less oversight.
Well, no, see, I think you're assuming that a shorter rule book means less oversight. I think you can have much better oversight with a shorter rule book. Have been arguing for the much shorter rule book for a generation.
It's not unusual. I mean, I by no means would argue that a longer book means better regulation.
That's what we have. Whenever we have a new problem, like with Enron, we got a longer rule book. We got Sarbanes-Oxley. We got more rules on top of old rules.
Yes, everything's Sarbanes-Oxley's fault, I'm sure.
No, I didn't know. This is just an example. With every new crisis that comes along, instead of some type of major rethinking of we need to fundamentally cut the number of regulations and modernize the system, we just add another layer of regulations onto what is already there. And see, the rule book gets longer and longer and longer.
I fully agree that this should be a quality discussion, not a quantity discussion.
Good, we agree.
We agree on that in principle. It would be great to have a broader debate about whether liberal regulations are of better or worse quality than conservative regulations, because I think often conservative regulations tend to be very toothless and not really with the intention of giving real oversight to the financial markets or the private sector in general.
Well, we'll have to come up with some good examples and have that debate sometime.
Sure. That aside for the moment.
Okay.
I do think that there's been more to the conservative blogger critique of McCain than the economics. There was a great deal of complaining on the corner with Michelle Malkin and some other sites. Why didn't McCain talk more about these guilt by association attacks that he was ramping up and Palin was ramping up beforehand, and then was not uttered during the debate? I thought probably the most sharp critique of that was from
Andy McCarthy.
Andy McCarthy.
Not only the most sharp, but the most plentiful. I feel as though every other post in the corner was Andy McCarthy talking about Bill Ayers. But go ahead.
But I have to say that for some reason I thought I had to print it out. Here we go. He said, great, memo to the McCain campaign. Someone is either a terrorist sympathizer or he isn't. Someone is either disqualified as a terrorist sympathizer or is qualified for public office. You help portray Obama as a clearly qualified presidential candidate who would fight terrorists. If that's what the public thinks, good luck winning this thing. Fire Dog Lakes, Blue Texan, had a roundup of a few others. Michelle Malkin, no mention of Ayers, no mention of Acorn, not even the feeblest attempt to expose Obama's radical roots, disaster. Dick Morris, I think he missed the jugular. He never brought up William Ayers. You can't go to the American people and say you shouldn't vote for Barack Obama because he's intimate with a terrorist who's as bad as Osama bin Laden and not mention it in a debate. And the headline of that post was, Wingnuts pissed that McCain didn't play Ayers' card, about to get pissier. It seems like there's a bit of disagreement within the conservative blogosphere what the McCain's problem is, but I think the side that is asking for more guilt by association smears seems to be resonating in those who are going to the McCain-Palin rallies. We saw a video was posted today about people at a McCain-Palin event talking about Obama is a terrorist, look at his name, look at his bloodlines. There seems to be some grassroots resonance on the right with that, but it doesn't seem to be being shared by the broad middle of the country.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's quite as clear cut of people on the right hoping he would talk about Ayers more often. There's a lot of pushback at the corner on the issue. David Frum actually had his own blog at National Review, writes, American voters are staggering under the worst financial crisis since at least 1982. Asset values are tumbling, consumer spending is contracting, and a recession is visibly on the way. This crisis follows upon 7 years in which middle-class incomes have stagnated and Republican economic management has been badly tarnished. Anybody who imagines that an election can be won under these circumstances by banging about on William Ayers and Jeremiah Wright is, to put it mildly, severely underestimating the electoral importance of pocketbook issues. And there was an even better and snappier take, I thought, from Stephen Greenhut at Pajamas Media. Based on the latest Republican talking points, I've learned that Barack Obama has a nefarious association with the 1960s-era terrorist, which suggests that the Democratic candidate harbors deep leftist sentiments. That might be frightening. Consider the possibilities. A President Barack Obama might socialize the nation's financial system, or, oh wait, never mind, that already happened last week.
Well, that brings up a different point, with the New York Times article talking about how Secretary of Treasury Henry Paulson might go farther with the bailout/rescue package and actually be buying shares in many of these struggling banks. Atria said, only Nixon could go to China, only Bush can finally bring the Marxist revolution home. So that seems to be also raising some hackles on the right, I take it.
Yes, definitely. Michelle Malkin has been a big leader against the bailout, and she was all over the New York Times article. She also kind of led with the oh no, Barack Obama's a socialist angle. There's a lot of blog buzz over Barack Obama's membership in the Socialist New Party. You can read more about it here. A year ago, I might have gotten as worked up about this as everyone else seems to be. But after watching a GOP White House and Republican collaborationists spork over billions upon billions in socialist aid to private business, presiding over the most massive national efforts I've seen in my lifetime over the past year, and then watching John McCain pitch his Treasury Department as national loan servicer plan during the debate, it's hard for me to muster up much more than much more angst than I already have. So I would say, yes, definitely, there is the National Review has an editorial out against it. So, I mean, there's not a lot of warmth on the right for the stepped up Paulson plan.
Is there a concern here? Because, you know, there are some folks on the left who were critical. I mean, I think the bailout rescue was split, you know, had split reactions on both sides of the ideological mm-hmm. fence. David Sroder works with me at Campaign for America's Future, strenuously against the bailout, mm-hmm. Came out with a more positive response to this new story. I know you love this post. As you told me in email ahead of time. This is what David Sroda said. Laying out the problem. Number one, a credit crisis occurs when banks stop lending. And two, the amount banks can lend is a multiple of the capital in their vaults. Therefore, ending a credit crisis means prompting new lending. And that means maximally increasing bank capital. Enter Paulson, the former Goldman Sachs executive and current Treasury Secretary. The bailout he fear-mongered through Congress aims to waste almost $1 trillion taxpayer dollars buying banks' bad mortgages. A scheme all but ensuring a disastrous outcome. If Paulson pays banks exactly what their mortgages are worth, he will not increase banks' capital or their lending ability. He will merely convert one asset, mortgages, into another, cash, making no impact on the credit crisis. If to protect taxpayers he buys mortgages at lower prices than banks list them, banks have to write down their capital and consequently contract lending, and the credit crisis will worsen. If Paulson overpays for mortgages, he may marginally augment bank capital, but also incur massive taxpayer losses when he later resells the mortgages at their real price. The silver lining is a little-known provision in the bailout bill allowing Paulson, if he chooses, to buy ownership stakes in banks. According to Robert Johnson, the Senate Banking Committee's former chief economist, this would cost roughly $375 billion less than the mortgage-buying plan, and better yet, more aggressively attack the credit crisis. Mortgages may be underpriced today, but they retain some value on banks' books. So rather than purchasing mortgages, a capital-neutral transaction, Paulson could buy bank stock, infusing banks with new capital on top of their mortgages that would exponentially increase lending capacity, prevent taxpayers from buying toxic assets, give the public a share of future profits, and grant regulators ownership leverage to restructure bank management. And then he goes on to question whether, you know, where is Paulson's true proclivities lie in helping the taxpayer, helping Wall Street CEOs. Is he a crony communist who wants to help out the CEOs, or is he a businessman who's putting the taxpayers' interest first, sort of reframing, you know, the whole notion of government intervention? So I bring that up in part one to show that there is some difference in how this is being reacted to on the left and the right, but also, you know, the entire tenor of the presidential debate has been, who's the better regulator at this point? There's been no real argument for deregulation anymore. There doesn't seem to be a wave of sentiment against government intervention in the midst of crisis. Is there any concern on the right that they are becoming more marginalized, that their ideology is becoming more marginalized in the wake of this crisis?
No. but let me just mention a few things that are just so horribly blatantly wrong about Sarada's post. First of all, the problem is not bad mortgages on the bank's end. It's the securities that are tied to bad mortgages that no one knows the value of. So when Sarada says that the problem with...
That's because these securities are mortgages that have been chopped up into bits.
Right.
And when the mortgages go bad, no one, it's hard to find out what exactly where the chain of the problem.
No, people know what the chain of the problem is. The problem is they don't know, you know, which of these securities are bad and which ones are not, and, you know, how much they're worth. Which leads us to, you know, why Sarada's post is just so terribly wrong, is that he says the Paulson plan wouldn't help at all because it would just exchange the mortgages for cash. But if the banks had cash on their books that was equal to what the mortgages were actually worth, there would be no problem. There'd be no credit crunch at all. The problem is that no one knows what these securities are worth, and so there is no market for them, so they can't turn them into cash. That is the basic thing of the problem, which Sarada just clearly doesn't grasp.
Well, I don't think that negates what he's saying at all.
It totally does.
I mean, you're absolutely right that that
he totally
is,
misstates the problem.
I don't think that's quite right. I completely agree with everything you just said, as far as the nature of the problem is, but. The securities are, while there is immense difficulty in determining their value, once you get to the point of government A buying assets from bank B, there's going to be an arrangement to buy them for something. And, you know, sort of talking about a scenario where they're essentially bought for what the banks say their value is, which would be a higher price than if the government comes and says, look, we're buying it for this. We're buying it for this bargain basement price. During the hearings, Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke talked about price discovery, that in doing this process, we would discover what the real prices of these assets are by entering into these arrangements. It's something that Paul Krugman thought was evidence of how ridiculous the plan was, that they were sort of going headlong into this without really knowing what the value
of
these things
were.
Right, right.
Which is why you can't turn them into cash.
But when push comes to shove, I mean, the whole point of this is to buy them for something. At that juncture, a price is going to be affixed to it.
At that time.
Right.
And then that price will go up or down later.
Yes, But the point is that...
he's saying there would be no net change, but there would be a change. The liquidity is the crisis. But that's just one problem. The other problem is when he says a little-known provision in the law allows Paulson to buy banks. This wasn't a little-known provision. The problem from a conservative perspective with the bill was that the language delegating authority to Paulson was so broad that he could do any number of things, including the TARP plan that he described, but also the bank plan, which the New York Times hints that he's doing, or also, added bonus, what McCain wants him to do. And this is what was just so fundamentally troublesome to conservatives about the plan, is that the delegation language gave so much power to Paulson without any language to rein in his discretion that when Congress signed over that bill, Paulson has the authority to do the TARP plan, which was what he originally sold it as, Dodd-Krugman-like nationalization of the bank plan, which is what apparently he seems going to be doing, or C, what McCain wants him to do, which is actually buying up his mortgages. He could do any of those, and it would all be legal. That's a little frightening.
Well, that's, I mean, and that is more of a philosophical dispute of what to how to go forward. I wouldn't think this was a well-known provision, and not a lot of high expectation he was going to do this. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a blaring headline on the New York Times today.
It was a shift in strategy, but it just goes to show that Serrata doesn't have a comprehension of what this legislation was, that he called it a little-known provision. It was the main delegation of authority language that was so broad that allowed him to – it's the same exact language that allowed him to do the TARP assets that is allowing him to do the bank equity. It's not a separate, smaller provision.
I think it's a little bit of a gratuitous attack towards Serrata there. I think all he's trying to say is that, one, it was not it's not well-known nationally that this was – a provision of the bill, and I think from a liberal perspective,
that's my
not
point.
A lot of high expectations.
You're saying it again, that it was a it's not a separate provision. It's the essence of the legislation.
Well, there's not a lot of high expectation on the left that the broad language there was going to be utilized in that way because it wasn't sold in that way. There was a lot of skepticism about that. They wanted that sort of thing to be much more firm that was what the strategy was going to be. So I don't think to make that big a deal. I don't think it's accurate to, you know, personally, you know, attack Serrata's knowledge on the subject just because there's some dispute over the meaning of what little known provision means.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's either little known or it's the main thrust or it's the main operating language in the bill.
Well, it was not accepted as fact that this was going to be the main thrust of it. Again, if everyone knew that was going to be the main thrust, this wouldn't be a news item in the New York Times today.
Well, again, it was a difference of attention. But I guess, you know, since we're kind of already on the subject of the bailouts, both Bush and McCain's, I think, you know, when McCain first announced his plan, it was unclear to pretty much everyone, you know, what the specifics were. Was this going to be, you know,
during McCain's mortgage plan that he announced at the
during the debate? You know, was this going to be, you know, a new plan requiring new legislation? Was this going to be in addition to the $700 billion? Was it going to be part of the $700 billion? And, you know, I always thought all along when I first heard it that it was going to be part of the same legislation. And then there was reports that it was not, that they were going to get you know, new separate legislation. But then on a conference call this morning, Douglas Holtz Eagan made clear that it was the same legislation. Ed Morrissey at Hot Air reports, on a conference call with reporters, McCain policy chief Doug Holtz Eagan spelled out how McCain would pay for his plan for the government to buy troubled mortgages and replace them with more favorable fixed-rate mortgages at minimal direct cost to the homeowners. The government could use the sum of the $700 billion authorized for the bailout and tap other accounts, although the campaign estimates that owing it to negative equity, the government can't magically turn bad mortgages into good ones without taking a hit. It would be about $300 billion. And McCain team hopes that by buying mortgages directly, the government would have to buy as many distressed assets from big banks, thus reducing the net cost. Blah, blah, blah. McCain claims it's his own idea, et cetera, et cetera. And then, as I said all along, the authority to do this plan is not new. It's not an additional $300 billion. It's using $300 billion of the already authorized $700 billion to hit more directly on mortgages rather than rescuing investors from their derivatives. So, again, like I said before, I think, you know, not only were conservatives dismayed that McCain, the standard bearer of our party, wants our government to become the country's largest landlord, but, you know, he didn't even need new legislation to do it. He was just using legislation that already the majority of at least the House Republican caucus you know, voted against because they knew this delegation language was just way too broad.
Well, there's different criticisms of it from the left. Brad DeLong, economist, I think he's at UCLA. I think he was an economist in the Clinton administration. He described the McCain plan as, quote, take $300 billion, pay double current market value to banks that have troubled mortgages on their books, thus give a present of $100 billion to the bankers who made the loans, acquire and regularize the mortgages of only two-thirds as many homeowners as could have been accomplished if $300 billion were invested wisely. There's a big difference here. Democrats want to prevent depression and support the financial markets by investing taxpayer money in banks with troubled assets. Republicans want to give taxpayer money away to the shareholders and managers of banks with troubled assets. I would say this is unbelievable, but I do believe it. Matthew Iglesias, who's now at the Center for American Progress, initially, at the first announcement of the McCain plan, said that this was in line with the Center for American Progress plan. And said, all joking aside, it's generally true that progressive policy operators always hoping some Republican somewhere will con to some of our ideas. It's generally difficult to achieve anything legislatively in the United States without some bipartisanship. Obama's made similar noises in the past. Hopefully McCain's embraced this idea means something like it can actually get done. But he then they actually took a line out of the plan, changed the entire nature of it, which prompted Iglesias to take back that phrase. And said, this transforms what could be a win-win measure to prevent mass evictions and a total collapse of housing prices to a strangely unmotivated subsidy to the people who issued bad loans. There's no need to do it this way. It would be cheaper and fairer to focus public expenditures on recapitalizing financial institutions in need of aid, while adjusting the foreclosure issue by haircutting the lenders. I think that's the part that was changed here, whether or not the lenders would actually take a loss during this process. Well, McCain has in the past stood with fellow conservatives in opposing mortgage rewrite efforts. He seems to have changed his mind once he thought of a way to help out the homeowners that managed to let the bad lenders avoid shouldering any of the burdens.
Yeah, well, the larger problem with both McCain's plan and all similar plans from the left is that it, you know, they just wouldn't work because pretty much any plan of this type is always going to have the provision that, you know, we're not going to help anybody out who lied on their mortgage application. We're not going to help anybody out who, you know, was practicing fraud. Or we're not going to help anybody out. We're only going to help out, you know, residential homeowners. We're not going to help out people who bought properties for investment. Well, the problem with that is once you cut out all those people, you're not helping a lot of people. You're not helping enough people that you're going to stabilize real estate prices. So much of this bubble was because you had people buying up so many investing properties so that they could flip them. And so if those investment properties all tank and you don't allow people who, you know, already in their own home are safe and rich and you don't bail them out, then you're not going to help the real estate prices bottom out because they don't qualify for aid. Same with the people that lie on the mortgage application. When you all of a sudden cut out everyone that nobody wants to help, these plans just aren't going to stabilize the housing market.
Well, this is where, you know, the conservative critique has long been that this was the fault of greedy homeowners, greedy, reckless, lying homeowners.
No, but it's more than that. I think we all. I mean, are you denying that a large part of this is also people buying up, you know, third and second, you know, residences in Florida and Los Angeles, hoping that they could flip them while, you know. How many stories have you heard out of California? People who have their own homes, but were, you know, got into the mortgage crisis later because they thought it would be a great investment opportunity.
Well, I don't need to remind you. We talked about this 2 weeks ago. I am a first-time homeowner who got snookered into a stupid adjustable-rate mortgage loan, even though I was not a subprime buyer. I could afford the house that I bought, yet I had a mortgage broker who shoved me
but
into something.
But didn't you also tell me that you got yours reworked and you're cool and you're not going to be foreclosed?
Well, I'm not.
Okay,
I mean,
so you're not part of the problem.
My situation wasn't as dire as some others because I wasn't subprime. I still lost money in the process.
So what you're telling me is you're not part of the problem and you're not seeking a bailout.
I'm not necessarily part a direct part of the problem, but I had a similar experience to people that are, and so I think it's. I don't know if we have statistics that say X number of people were the liars and X number of people were the victims that got, you know, preyed upon.
No, but we do have a CBO report because, you know, the first time we did the housing bailout bill, when Dodd and Frank wrote their first bill, they had a proposal much like this where they wanted to basically, you know, have the cut down and, you know, rework everyone's loans. And, you know, the CBO did an estimate of how much would it cost, and the cost was very, very low. Not because, you know, the plan was going to work so well and it was guaranteed that the government would make back a lot of money, just because it would help out so few people. And the reason that it would help out so few people is that so few people would qualify because so many of the problems that are out there were because of fraud and were because of investing.
This was based on what, Bush's Hope Plan?
No. This was not the Hope Plan. That's completely voluntary. The Dodd-Frank bill ended up being voluntary too. But no, I'm talking about the housing bailout passed earlier this year.
Not the one that just passed.
Not the Wall Street bailout bill that just passed, but when the government took over Fannie and Freddie, right? There's also with that a larger housing bailout package that the Democrats have been trying to push all summer, but that the Republicans had pushed back on. And in order to get the Bush administration, for the Bush administration to be allowed to take over Fannie and Freddie, the Democrats put in most of their bill that they'd been trying to get all passed all summer, and not the Republicans in general, but Bush signed off on it.
Well, I haven't read the CBO report. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at it to know.
I'll include the link.
Those parameters were so.
I'll email it to you right after we're done.
Please do. I'm not gonna forgive. I don't take you at face value. That is the definitive claim to say that that so few people involved here are legitimate victims, and therefore it'd be impossible to do this in a way that would actually stabilize the housing markets.
Right. So we've talked about the McCain plan.
Yes.
I don't think we've talked about – well, no, we have talked about the Paulson plan a lot. But let me go ahead and, kind of pitch my own plan because contrary to popular beliefs in the comments, we do actually have internal policy debates here at Heritage. And so there was lots of dissent about what the Heritage position should be. And I was pushing for a position that would have both, I thought, limited the delegation language problem and made it very narrow, but also addressed the capitalization problem. And it was one along the lines very similar to what Paulson's proposing now and what the Dodd plan was. But basically I was pushing for warrants, which would, have Treasury buy equity in the banks in exchange for basically options of stock that then the government could sell later, after a number, 5-10 years, to private investors for money, so that it was, essentially like a loan. The liquidity problem would be solved because the banks would be getting the money now, and then the government and the legislation would not allow the government to exercise the options, but would allow them to sell them to private investors who then could. So then that would have, A, made the delegation language very narrow so that we had a very specific idea of what Paulson was going to do, and B, it would have recapitalized the banks, and C, kind of to tie back to your question about what is conservative and what is liberal when it comes to regulation, this would be a government intervention in markets that, was a very, it was an emergency time. So it was still a pretty big intervention, but it would be one that was simple and uncomplicated and small enough and had a very few number of working parts, as opposed to government going in like McCain wants to and becoming a national landlord, which I find to be completely unconservative. But anyways, that's my rant and solution.
All right.
All right, then.
Let no one say that Con Carroll has no ideas. The other thing that struck me in the blogosphere the last couple of days, unrelated to the financial crisis, was the YouTube Senator Norm Coleman's spokesman gamely trying to deflect questioning from the Minnesota Press Corps about reports that he has his Neiman Marcus suits bought by a businessman friend of his. This started to percolate in the blogosphere. I think it got some mainstream media attention in Minnesota. And so spokesman's giving a press conference. And he has a stock line that he says that Senator Coleman reports every gift that he's been given. And no matter what question gets thrown at him, he just keeps, did this guy buy suits for him? Senator Coleman reports all his gifts. Does that mean that he actually bought these suits? Senator Coleman reports all his gifts. But the gift requirements say that's only true for gifts over a certain price value. Is it possible that these suits were less than that? They would have to be reported. And then you'd go with the same exact thing. Senator reports all of his
gifts.
He was
on message. You got to give him that.
He was on message. Well, and that's what struck me about this. A number of things struck me about this. One, it really seemed to zip through the blogosphere. You saw a lot of, Daily Kos, Mighty D, Ezra Klein, and others, the Minnesota blogs, even mainstream media blogs like Politico and Mark Ambender. It was so striking to see somebody give the talking points regardless of the question when it clearly wasn't answering the questions. That it had this feel of, could this be a crystallizing issue that reshapes the Minnesota Senate race, one that Coleman was beating Al Franken very handily through much of the summer. Polls already started to turn after the economic crisis, before this scandal, potential scandal, started to bubble up. And when people start talking about, can Democrats hit 60 Senate seats after this election, it's a race like that that has to go the Democrats' way for them to have the hope of having a filibuster-proof majority. And the second thing about it that struck me as interesting is, you know, what that spokesman was doing is pretty standard, you know, PR damage control fare. You have a stock line, you repeat it at all costs, and so when the print media story comes out the next day, that's the line that's in there. Or when there is the two-minute package in the local TV news, that's the soundbite that gets used. In a YouTube era, when you can see, when the entire press conference can be shot around the internet in a matter of minutes, it obviously looks much more phony and inauthentic and evasive than it would be 10 years ago. So that struck me as sort of a potential Makaka-esque moment that not only could make Norm Coleman lose his seat, but might be the tipping point where the Democrats can't have a filibuster-proof majority or not.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and dissent there. You know, the Makaka thing was worked so well because it, you know, fit into the, you know, George Allen is a racist hick frame that they were trying to put around him. And, you know, it had a racially tinged hard charge issue. And, you know, it did frame him early on and sink the campaign. This is very late in the game, and, you know, I don't see how where Norm Coleman gets his suits from fits into a larger message of the Franken campaign.
Well, I think it's going to fit into a larger message of that he is, you know, so deeply enmeshed in the Washington ways. And coddling up to special interests that he's
wasn't it a Minnesota guy? Wasn't it a Minnesota Neiman Marcus person?
I believe it was, but
so he's enmeshed in the Neiman Marcus culture of Minnesota.
If that's Norm Coleman's response, hey, this wasn't a Washington guy; it was a Minnesota businessman.
Yeah, I just don't think the Minnesota Senate race is going to turn on where Norm Coleman gets his suits.
Franken almost lost this thing because of some ridiculous accounting error.
No. That was not a ridiculous accounting error. That was a long established pattern of him not paying taxes.
Right. So, if such a totally penny ante issue,
you obviously never have any friends who started startups who got dinged by the IRS because they didn't pay their taxes. Paying taxes is a big deal. Where you buy your suits isn't.
And he paid his taxes.
After he got caught not paying taxes and had to go back and pay back taxes.
The taxes were wrong. He was paying in the wrong states. It wasn't he was trying to evade taxes. It was an accounting error. So the taxes were being put in the wrong place. He was called out and it was fixed. And it did damage to his campaign because the worst narrative that you could spin out of that had taken hold.
Yes, I hear Charles Ringel also has some accounting problems in Congress with his investment properties in the Dominican Republic. Lots of Democratic accounting problems creeping up. Should be fun.
Is that where you're going to go? Is that going to be the saving grace of this election for conservatives?
No, it's not. But it'll be a great storyline for the next Congress.
So we're already cooking
Charles
up.
Ringel.
What do we do once we're in the we're deeply in the minority? How do we get this?
Charles Ringel, head of the committee.
What penny ante scandals can we trump up?
Charles Ringel, penny ante scandals. The New York Times and Washington Post have called for Charles Ringel to resign. I guess you call that penny ante, but yeah, no.
Maybe,
I mean, the chairman of the committee that writes America's tax laws can't pay his taxes and blamed his wife for the account for, as Bill would put it, the accounting error.
I don't know a lot about the Charlie Rangel story. Maybe he's the most corrupt guy on the planet. I honestly don't know. If he's busted, has to resign, so be it. As far as I don't think that is going to be a pivotal thing that is going to regain It's going to save the election for Republicans. I don't think it's going
to... I never said it would. We started this conversation talking about suits from Neiman Marcus.
And I fully, and I'll fully concede that it's a, it is arguably a silly thing.
Okay, good. It's a silly thing.
For the election to turn on, unless there is something larger to the story. With, I mean, the only thing that's strange about, I mean, when Franken was hit for his tax thing, he owned up to it and paid the taxes. And it still hurt him for a long time. But he did put the issue behind him. The only thing that, the basic issue, this guy got suits bought for him that are lower than the gift limit. It really isn't that big of a deal. The only thing that's strange about it is the evasive response to it that makes one wonder, is there more to the story that we don't know about? And if that's the way the Coleman campaign handles this, I think it could be very damaging for his campaign. Now, I don't think that should be what elections turn on. They should turn on how they're going to handle the economic crisis and their foreign policy problems around the world. But it is possible that because interest of the whole This Week in Blog mission, what is happening in the blogosphere and how it relates to discourse, I do think it's notable that a YouTube like that made the rounds and could have a determining factor on that election.
Color me underwhelmed.
We will see.
Fair enough.
I mean, do you think if Coleman loses, it'll be for some other reason?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Do you think if Coleman won, it would be because of Franken's tax thing or because of issues?
I think the tax thing definitely helped. Alrighty.
Do we have anything else, sir?
No, I think we're good.
Always
going to talk to you, Bill.
So you'll be off next week?
Yes, I'm co-oping at my son's preschool.
Very nice of you. You are a nurturer?
Nurturer, yes. Sure, why not?
We don't know who you have in store for me next week.
No, we do not yet. Do you have any requests?
I like all your Next Right buddies.
Okay. I think they're all good to go. We'll see if John, John last time was on a plane, so he couldn't, but he'll probably will say yes. Okay.
All right, then. I'll talk to you in a few weeks. I guess when we talk next... Well, it won't be quite election day yet.
We'll be close, though. And I will almost be about to be relieved of my boredom.
All right, well, have a good weekend. You too.